Accession number 10613, reel 5.
Major Charles Burden Taylor, reel 5. What briefing did you get either on or just before you got onto Vimy Ridge prior to the Arras counterattack on the 21st of May?
Very, very little. I don't think a great deal was known as to exactly what was happening. And I think it might be hindsight in thinking about it, but we were to carry out this attack to meet up with the French. We would be attacking south-southwestward, roughly, and to meet up with the French coming up from the south. And it would be a tank infantry attack. And other than that, I think the details were really related to timings only, and that PSR vehicles would be left on Vimy Ridge and until later called up, etc. But then we went off on foot.
And what was your company's role to be?
At that time, we were going to be held in reserve in D Company, A and D. I suppose it must have been a three-company attack. A, B. Certainly, A and D companies were forward, and B must have been forward, but I'm certain that there was no one behind us.
Now, had you just? This is a sideline. Had you had any practice? You were working with the 7th Armoured Division. Had you had any practice at combined attacks?
No.
Or cooperation with tanks?
No, not at all.
And did you have any method of communicating with either the actual tanks or with the command structure?
Well, I shouldn't laugh about this, because really it was a very sad occasion, I suppose. But why I'm chuckling is purely and simply that at that time that might have been one of the sort of tactical side of life that we just hadn't really been able to tackle it in a practical viewpoint. We may have had the theory of what would go on, but the tanks went off possibly too energetically, because at that time there was certain training which said that the infantry would go forward behind the tanks. In other words, they'd be protected as they walked behind them. But the tanks, well, they went off, and we, as far as I'm concerned, I saw a few of them, and then we didn't see any more at all. Later on I saw the odd French light tank, but there was some lack of coordination somewhere that, I mean, the tanks would have been bloody annoyed, I think, to have been left on their own. It's not like a tank battle in the desert where they can fight tank v tank. This was close country, and they would reckon to be close to the infantry to be given protection from close in fighting from enemy infantry. But who sent them off, or whether they were too energetic of a bash at the Hun and so on, I don't know.
Now, what exactly, you were in reserve. What was the role of a reserve company in an attack like this, or what was it in this particular occasion?
Well, as I said, the detailed briefing, I can't recall anything of any substance other than what I've said. But under the circumstances, we were meant to attack. If, in fact, I suppose there was Jerry in that area, as it turned out there was, but as you know, it was a very flexible war at that time, so we might well have gone straight through and met up with the French on the other side. On the other hand, as things turned out, being engaged by A and B companies, certainly out front, A and D companies, and B, contact with the enemy, as it happened, we were outgunned and compelled to withdraw. Had we had, shall we say, a great success, and there was a necessity to go forward to consolidate, then C Company would have gone forward of the companies and consolidated at a next point farther on. Failing that, we could have withdrawn to cover the withdrawal of the other companies. As it was, we all seemed to withdraw at one time.
What actually happened to you that day, do you remember?
Well, as they say nowadays, not a lot. Because we weren't committed to anything. Well, the company, one platoon was committed to this particular graveyard where some of the Germans of this column that had been shot up by the tanks were in fact, I don't remember them causing any great trouble, but we knew they were there and they had to be taken, they had to be eliminated or captured.
The cemetery at Duisans?
Yes, I think that's the name. But anyway, it was at that time. So Jeff Foreman with his platoon went over and sorted that out. And the next thing was, really, I had to just wander around, seeing where the chaps were, where they happily dug in, and
so
that was all.
You stayed upon Vimy Ridge, did you?
No, not me. I was with my company.
And they were
in the Arras attack.
Further south?
No, not further south. We were behind the three leading companies.
So you went forward?
But oh yes. Forward.
Sorry, I was
yep.
Yes.
No, it's not like we all went forward together. Yeah.
So what happened then, as far as you?
Well, then we were we found that certain elements of the forward companies were withdrawing. That's a nice thing from the point of view of the general staff. We were tremendously bucked when suddenly a staff car rolled up with the divisional commander in. And to see somebody with red brass and nicely, neatly turned out the British form and so on, we felt, well, you know, if they can come up here, then it's good for us. A very good morale booster. Yeah. And other than that, we then had to withdraw, which we did, and withdrew to Vimy Ridge. And the next night, it would be, I was put into Givenchy with a platoon, in a house overlooking a crossroads with a fairly generous order that they were expecting Jerry tanks to come through followed by infantry, and I had to cover the crossroad, do nothing but let the tanks come through and then try and shoot up the infantry. And round about 3 o'clock in the morning I was very glad to be relieved of that task and then we went on to motored back to towards Lens.
Now, were you aware at the time of I mean, the Arras counterattack is quite famous now. Were you aware at the time that you'd been part of, or even if in reserve, part of quite an eventful attack?
No.
Or did it just seem...
No, just part of the job, really. I mean, as far as we were concerned, there could have been, 150 other tank infantry attacks. No, subsequent to that, because I think that was the only combined of that nature that was carried out in that particular period. You know, a so-called combined infantry tank attack.
So you were falling back after you'd had this detached job at Givenchy.
Yes.
What happened there? You fell back?
Fell back towards Lens. And then we got, I think, it was that time that we came into the Carver area, and there was a fair amount of chaos going on, and I recall moving. I'm sorry, there's a little gap, because somewhere in this time, due to the loss of company commanders, I was taken from Charlie Company and given A Company, what was left, I think there were about 60 of them, under a sergeant. And when we got into the Carver area, we were moving, in fact, we were moving back as well to join our transport. And for once I disobeyed an order, inasmuch as a totally unknown brigadier to me said that I had to turn round and go and attack Carver, just like that. And I said, well, I couldn't do anything without, orders from my own CO, which I thought was a reasonable answer, which he accepted. And I may say, very shortly afterwards, I got an order from Ross McLaren to say that we should attack Carver. But there's nothing there. And very much, I suppose one could blarney up, but really, in a way, it was a march through Carver to the other side, where we took up positions. Then we got sniped, and we got mortared. And I sent, 3 runners back to battalion headquarters to say what the situation was, because this wasn't obviously going to be a permanent situation. And I'm very thankful that I read in an army manual before the war that warfare would not be like the trench warfare, that leaders, officers and so on had to, if they were under duress or at any such and such time, must not be blind to their orders, but they must interpret. And so I did a bit of interpreting at this time, because I could see no reason why we were there. There was nothing, hold to the last man and last round or anything like that. And then I walked into a light tank of the French army, and I suppose part of a cavalry regiment, and they were pulling out. Well, basically the cavalry are the last to pull out, in general terms. They might not take me literally. But and I thought, right, if I'm going to be in front of that sort of thing, I shouldn't be here. So I remembered that particular bit in the manual and pulled back. And thank goodness I turned out as right in doing so.
During this retirement, you'd been going for quite a while. Was fatigue becoming a problem for either you or your men at that stage, after round about the carving time?
Yes, I would say it certainly was, because I was tired, and let's face it, I joined rather late, and I hadn't had to do that extra marching that they had done prior to the Arras attack, in the days prior to the Arras attack. But I don't know, it's whether it's a question of just having, well, you just press on, that's the main thing, and you can't just stop. Certainly you can't stop in war and just say, I must have a kick.
What do you think, what were the symptoms of fatigue as they affected your efficiency, do you think?
Yes.
Did it not go that far yet?
I don't really think I can recall anything really stopping me thinking, because there was one time when, frankly, I could have been very annoyed at one job that I had to do, the question of going to guard a flank and that sort of thing, and I'd been sent off to do this, and it had to be done for such and such a period, and then I had to come back, and this was on the Ypres Canal, and there was a thought that there could be a flank attack coming in, and so I was sent off to the right a fair march, and got established on the line that I was told, and then came back at the appointed time, and everyone vamoosed. I went into battalion headquarters, no one there, and as you mentioned, one was very fatigued anyway at that time, but the last contact I'd had towards the enemy was liaising with the 6th battalion, so I thought, well, I better go and check up, see if they're still there, and took a motorbike and motored off, I suppose, half a mile, 3/4 mile, parked the bike in a ditch, went up to the canal area, and lo and behold, no 6DLI. So they pulled out, the 8th pulled out, so that meant really there was nothing between me and the other chaps. And pulled the bike out of the ditch, got back onto the road, which was in line away from the enemy side. And then I realised, by sort of whistling past my lugs, that I was being sniped at, which could have annoyed me even further and could have put me off, shall we say. On the other hand, I remember consciously was thinking, well, I wonder if they've taken my B-Echelon, my vehicles, and the colour sergeant and cooks and so on. And luckily I did, because I found them, bless their hearts. It was, I would say, oblivious to the situation as I was, with the cooks and with the cookers and the 2 trucks. And I think I had about 60 chaps left then. So we put them all onto 2 1500 weights, and I knew roughly where the battalion would be going. And so off we motored, going around the corners very slowly, got to be rather top heavy, and finally rejoined the battalion.
That was one problem you had then. What about refugees? Were they getting in the way at all?
Oddly enough, at this particular time, they weren't, and thank God they weren't, because that could have held us up. But certainly behind Vimy, the refugee problem was pretty hefty. And it was really, man's inhumanity to man, one might be thinking about. On the other hand, I think one had to think that you were there to do a job, And so therefore you had to get on with it. And you had to just make your way through. But they were a perishing nuisance, bless them. The other side of the coin, around the Gavoisiera area, a certain amount of dive bombing came in that area. And I knew that a number of refugees had been killed. And I've never forgotten that we had to withdraw in the darkness, that somewhere or other there was... I'd seen a woman, really half a woman, in the village that time. And when we had to withdraw through that village, I hoped to God that I wouldn't sort of trip over or anything like that. And in effect, it was pitch black dark when we moved out. And I remember standing, and it must have been standing on a body, and it really must have been this woman, which was a little bit queasy making. And also in the distance we could hear babies crying, which no way at that time could anything be done. But that was pathetic too.
What about supplies? Were you able to... I mean, you were moving about France, Belgium in a fairly erratic fashion. Were the yep. supply able to keep up with you?
Not all the time, but I must say that when one thinks about the sort of shifting about, the jockeying about, the fact that we got anything to eat, I think, is a sort of congratulatory message which you must send to all the cooks and the B.H.N.O. staff and so on. I think that... I can only recall one time when, I think for 2 days, we'd... Oddly enough, I think a couple of bars of chocolate, not the emergency ration, and a couple of hardtack biscuits, packets of biscuits, was really all we had in our water bottle. And on the other hand, we survived that, but we were moving the whole time, so we didn't really have time to think, ooh, I'm hungry, or anything like that. And, of course, a great summer, so perhaps we just didn't need that amount. But I think the funniest thing that I've come across, which is typical of the good old Geordie, that one time we were caught up by the rations, and a magnificent stew came up. Absolutely, it must have had 2 days' rations of meat in it, and thick. And another 6-gallon food container full of excellent... fruit salad, you know, the tinned stuff, and cherries all over the place. And this was a magnificent meal. It really made up for the previous 2 days. But the first reaction from the lads was, "Why, there's nae bloody char." In other words, there wasn't a container of tea, and I think they would have given all the stew and all the fruit salad merely for a good muck of strong, sweet tea.
Now, you'd rejoined, after you'd picked up the B Echelon troops and you got on the trucks, yeah. You rejoined the 8th. Whereabouts were they by the time you caught up with them? Or where were
that,
they?
Can I say that we were heading for the beaches? I don't think any of us realised that at the time. Ross McLaren may well have had some orders, but it was then just really a sort of leapfrog backwards, position to position, until finally, I suppose, we must have been on the... inside the inner circle and marching to towards the beaches themselves.
Now, were you in was there any more actual direct action during that period, or was this just the retreat?
Withdrawal. We got again something which was gave me a little kick. It sounds daft maybe, but we're coming back in one particular area in a wood on the side of the road, and this was obviously fairly long-range machine gun fire, which was really coming through us sideways. And you could see sort of wherever the Germans had 1-in-6 tracer. And I'm leading the lads out, and turned round when we heard this funny pinging noise as certain bullets hit trees and others went on. And I turned round, and the whole flipping lot had gone to ground. And I said, virtually, what the hell's going on? Come on, we're off. And no hesitation, they involuntarily lay down very quickly, but their reaction to a simple, quiet order that we get cracking was equally electric, and which goes back to what we were talking about earlier, this question of drill and discipline and automatic action when orders are given. That was one. We had a lot of, what are these spotter aircraft, Storch, just come over and have a look at it. Occasional shelling, not a great deal. Certain amount of noise in the distance. I remember a certain aircraft going across, Jerry aircraft, which didn't attack us, but they were obviously going for the beaches, I think. And I recall one Geordie saying that if only he could see a flying flea with roundels on. A flying flea was a little miniature aircraft which was being built before the war, because we'd seen really no RAF at all, and of course subsequently we know exactly why, which was quite right. Pity there may have been. But this lovely crack from the Geordie saying that if only you could see a flying flea with a roundel on, he'd be satisfied. And so we gradually moved back, and a little shelling in the beach area.
You told me the rum ration, the rum was...
Oh, that was disgraceful. When I picked up my two 1500 weights and the colour sergeants and so on, at that time we had two jars of rum in one of the vehicles. And I thought, well, that sounds a good idea. We might later on push out a little snip to everyone. But we never saw it again. So that somebody got their mitts on it. Still, that's one of the fortunes of war, I think.
Well, now, when you got back to Dunkirk, were you aware of, or had anybody told you what the strategic situation was at all? Did you understand what had happened to the BEF?
I think understand what had happened to the BEF, perhaps not quite so much, no, because I don't recall being ever given the big picture. I think one was rather more affected, what is affecting me? And whether that's a question of possibly not thinking widely enough at age 20, I don't know. But the way we got back to UK, you would have thought that we were coming back to a great victory, because on the trains coming back, the houses were all bedecked and well done, Tommy, and all the rest of it.
What was the actual scene at Dunkirk when you got there?
A certain amount of smoke in the town, people going out seawards, where they were being picked up, not in on a vast scale at that point. We were halted and we spread out into an anti-aircraft and anti-shelling situation, and obviously at the far end near the mole things were happening. I think that's the best way of putting it. There seemed to be a lot of movement in that area, but between us and the mole there were other troops who were like us sitting down. And so we got stuck in once again, sock changing and tidying oneself up, and really waiting for the next order. I mean, it was obvious by now that we're going to be taken off, so from that point of view something rather drastic had happened. I think after that some Spitfires came over, and that raised one hell of a roar of applause. Then we were ordered to move on towards the mall, and again at that time, coming back to the discipline and self-discipline, we went forward in what I seem to remember is called artillery order, in other words spread out, and the remains were in three platoons, but they were spread out. They could have been doing it as a drill in Fenham Barracks, and it was absolutely magnificent to think after all this time, because everyone was pretty knackered, that they just automatically accepted, okay, you said you get into artillery formation. We all did, and they went across. I was proud of them, because I mean, to hell with what the guards were supposed to have done. The Tyneside guards were equal to everything, as far as I was concerned.
So you, the discipline, and you were still a cohesive unit.
Yep. I don't think that ever stopped, in all fairness, no matter, I mean, a company is about 120, 130. I think I had about 60 at that time. But we still operated as an organised team. That never stopped. And there was no lack of discipline.
And do you know what day you were taken off?
I think it was the day before Dunkirk closed.
And what do you actually remember about that?
By the time we were taken off along the Mall, and...
Was the Mall under fire at the time?
Yes, and the town was under fire as well, and I remember there's a gap in the wall, actually. It was a bit difficult to get across. Anyway, we got across, but there were two lines, one side French and the other side British. And the fellow at the end of the wall, by the, we came off on a destroyer, and the this fellow was saying, whatever it was, two Frenchmen and four British, or something like that. We were being rationed. Certainly the French were being rationed. And we were then left off. And once my chaps were on, I said, OK, well, I'll go. And I was grabbed and put down into a small wardroom on board ship. My lads were all right.
This was a destroyer?
Destroyer, yep. Can't remember the name of the destroyer, but I believe it's a short name, like Lynx or something like that. But I wouldn't know.
And your duty was to get on after your men?
Oh, yes. No, that's always. If you're getting jabs, you go first. If you have inoculation jabs, you go first. If you're in trouble, you come out last.
Was there any... You were on the destroyer. Was there any further problems?
No further problems, because the Navy really took over. And we were pushed down, very cramped, obviously. And the next thing was a fried egg on a piece of bully. And this was just something incredible. We could still hear the odd explosion outside, and but one didn't worry at that time. I mean, if anything was going to happen, then I'd rather reckon that, okay, well, that's the end. But knocked back the egg and the bully, and then underneath the table, bloody uncomfortable, but I just went to sleep. And the next thing was that the captain wanted us to go up on the bridge to see the White Cliffs of Dover, which was lovely. I mean, we got in darkness.
Did you know that's where you were going to? Did you? Or did
no, not at that time. But he brought us up to sea. Also, he said he was going to make one trip, further trip back. And did we by any chance have any spare 38 ammunition? And so we all anted up our dozen rounds and handed them over.
Now, there was one other story about Dunkirk you told me at the preliminary about of how you jettisoned your greatcoat.
Yes. That was a very, very fine summer, and at one point I thought, well, this seems madness, I'm not going to carry this thing all the way. And finally, I would say, after Dunkirk, I went into hospital and leave. So probably about a month later, when I rejoined the battalion and rejoined my own company, I was presented with my greatcoat, which one of the chaps had brought back all the way from where I'd jettisoned it and carried it throughout.
So he picked it up
and said, "Oh, we must hang on to this," which was a jolly good effort, really, when you think about it.
Now, you said you got a big reception when you got back to England from the civilians.
Ah,
was that in Dover, or was that?
It was, well, we didn't see much in Dover because, well, once we got out of the station, really, we really went to sleep, and then we stopped off at some station in between, and windows being knocked, and we were given tea, the WVS, and those sort of people were dishing out tea and chocolate and things, and so then we were rather kept awake, and I remember giving somebody a message on a cigarette packet. Could they ring my family and just say that I'm all right? And that I hoped had been done. But other than that, the train went on, and as I said before, outside windows were open and people were waving and bandings and bunting and well done, Tommy, and that sort of thing. You'd think it was a great victory. And that's the way it was all the way until we got to Borden.